You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. I'm WFHB News Director Wes Martin. On today's Daily Local News episode, we'll take a retrospective on some of our best reporting from 2017. These and other stories are always available on WFHB's website, WFHB.org.
We'll start today's broadcast with an interview with the Reverend Forrest Gilmore, who runs the Bloomington Shalom Center. The status of homeless individuals in downtown Bloomington was an ongoing concern for members of the city's administration and downtown business owners throughout 2017. Contributions from the City of Bloomington, Monroe County government, and private donations extended Shalom's hours of operations throughout weekends. In this interview, I speak with Reverend Gilmore about the expansion of Shalom's hours. What are some of the services that Shalom Center provides for those who don't know?
A host of services. We're basically that front door resource center for people experiencing extreme poverty. So when you have kind of a really serious kind of poverty crisis, you know, we're often a good place to come to first and get those basic needs addressed, get that basic safety addressed, particularly if you're experiencing homelessness or issues around hunger. We provide meals, shelter, showers, laundry, mail services, storage, a lot of the basics, you know, that people need to succeed. And then we take that further with services that help people get out of their situation. So that's case management, that's support with things like health care and most importantly, perhaps employment and housing.
Reverend Gilmore, have you seen an increase in the number of clientele that you serve? What was the impetus for the mayor to ask Shalom to stay open on the weekends?
So it came out as a recommendation from the Downtown Safety, Civility, and Justice Task Force. And the recommendation was given based on noticing something, which was that when Shalom was open, there were fewer incidents and concerns and things around police interactions with people who are downtown or people experiencing homelessness. So the whole philosophy behind this is let's open on the weekends and see if we can reduce some of those incidents in addition to the humanitarian side of providing for people in need 7 days a week. So our hope is by being open 7 days a week, it'll create more safety and security for everybody in our community. So the last several years, we've seen a steadying in the number of people experiencing homelessness in our community. And actually in the last year, we've probably seen a decrease in our, the number of meals, for example, that we serve, and a slight decline in the number of homeless people that we've counted.
And where are all of these people from? Are majority of them from the kind of counties, Monroe County and the surrounding region, or do you see people from all over?
Yeah, the vast majority, not just the majority, but, 80% or more are from Monroe and surrounding counties, probably, at least somewhere in the range of 70% or so are from Monroe County itself. With a good portion of the rest of the folks being from around neighboring counties. And then, we almost all probably at least I would say somewhere in the range of 9 and 10 are Hoosiers. And we get occasionally we get somebody from out of state. That's usually Kentucky or sometimes Illinois or Ohio. And sometimes, even places farther than that. But the vast majority of people are Hoosiers.
Are most of your clients, do you see them in chronic homelessness, or is this kind of just an acute need?
it varies. I mean, the majority of our clients get out of homelessness in pretty short order. So the average stay for a person experiencing homelessness is somewhere in the range of 30 days. So we do see a lot of people move on very quickly. We help them, support them until they're back on their feet and get out of that emergency. And then we see, you know, a small number, relatively speaking, somewhere in the range of 15% or so of people who are experiencing chronic homelessness, long-term homelessness, disabilities associated with that homelessness. So we tend to see those folks more often because their homelessness is so severe and their challenges are so severe. They have a lot of needs and that requires a lot of support. So we definitely see our chronically homeless folks quite a bit more than they represent from the numbers. We've been open about 7 days a week for about a month now, and it's been a pretty successful opening. We've had a few, you know, glitches here or there just with integrating new staff and new programming, but we are very fortunate to have a great new team working our weekend hours, and it's gone pretty smoothly and really well. It's been a gift to the many people who are experiencing homelessness and creating this safe place for people. So we've been very excited to be doing it.
My understanding that the city was asking for private investment into helping fund the Shalom Center to stay open on weekends. And this is the first year. And what monies have you seen come in so far?
Yeah, so we've been pledged money from the city and we've received money from the county. We've also received an anonymous $22,000 gift, and we've also received a gift directly from Kilroy's. There are a couple other commitments out there too as well that we haven't seen yet, but we know those commitments are in place.
And just to be clear, you haven't received anything from the city yet, but you have from the county?
I believe that's correct, yes.
How much money does it take in order to ensure that the Shalom Center will be open on the weekends, at least for the end of this year and going into next year?
It's a little hard to predict because we're, you know, it's all new. But we, after discussing it with our board, we decided to hire four staff members to run the program, a shelter supervisor, a shelter monitor, and a cook and a custodian, as well as we added some hours to our volunteer coordinator position. So in addition to food and utilities, those are the bulk of our costs. That's one extra position that we put in the original plan because we felt like we needed the extra support since there are much fewer staff members here on the weekend. So all told, it probably costs somewhere in the range of $85,000 for the weekend opening throughout the year.
Reverend Gilmore, is there anything else that you think our listeners should know or anything you'd like to add that we haven't touched on yet?
Probably the biggest thing I would love for people to do is to consider volunteering. We'd love to involve people more actively in our work, especially on the weekends now. We're looking to recruit volunteers to fill those slots and also at our overnight shelter, Friends Place, in the evening. So if people like to volunteer, we encourage them to email us at volunteer@shalomcommunitycenter.org.
Reverend Gilmore, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to the best of 2017 on WFHB. I'm your host for the next half hour, Wes Martin. I was speaking about the expansion of the Shalom Community Center's hours with the Reverend Forrest Gilmore in that interview from November. The Indiana Department of Natural Resources sold 299 acres of Yellowwood State Forest to a logging company this fall. The decision to award the $108,000 contract was met with outrage from state scientists and environmental activists. Brown County resident and Indiana Forest Alliance volunteer Dave Seastrom speaks with me in this next interview about the logging in Yellowwood. Mr. Seastrom, were you present over this past week when the logging bids came in? It's my understanding that there was quite a protest outside of Yellowwood.
Yeah, it was actually a pretty big event. In the past, there have been other logging protests at the same venue, but 10 to maybe a dozen people would show up. And what's happened now is because of the way they've changed logging, dramatically increased the rate of logging, how they're doing. It's evident to a lot of people that they're turning our wild state forests into industrial tree farms. And so there were some 250 people. That's an estimate. We don't actually know the hard numbers. And we're not talking about young hippies and animal costumes. We're talking about mature adults who come from a wide variety of backgrounds who are all deeply concerned.
It's my understanding that there was a bid put forward for $150,000 that the state rejected because they didn't have a license to bid on timber sales in the state. The state ended up taking that bid for $108,000, and I was wondering, do you have an opinion as to that?
It was a flooring manufacturer from southern Indiana that offered that bid. And that bid was $150,000 to lease those 300 acres for the next 100 years to preserve it. And he was turned down because the DNR, first of all, they want you to manage the property. So if you win a bid and you have 18-month log, if you do not complete the logging, they resell the timber 18 months later. So that's already been tried in the past. But this is different. This is a private concern, and his whole issue is, as a wood product manufacturer, he can't even buy Indiana timber. It's all going to China. It's being shipped to China in shipping containers in whole logs. So it comes back to the United States as a finished product, and all those jobs are lost. Now, that was a legitimate offer, and they turned it down out of hand because it didn't qualify in their management practices, and also the technicality that he was not a licensed timber buyer.
So if I can ask, what comes next for the Forest Alliance?
We are developing a strategy where we are canvassing in Indianapolis, in Brown County. We're knocking on people's doors, we're informing them. The amount of support that we're getting is overwhelming. We're asking people to put, we've just printed up another 1,000 yard signs that ask people to call the governor and halt this timber sale, which he can do. And basically, we're just going to hammer contacting your representatives and the governor and ask them to halt this sale. One of the things about this backcountry that's really relevant to the whole story is the fact that the backcountry itself, which was set aside by Governor Orr in 1981 as a preserve with very limited logging, okay, it was understood that this is a pristine special area that needs to go in perpetuity for all Hoosiers to enjoy. It represents 1.7% of all the state forests. So we have 13 state forests, and this is just 1.7%, but it represents 50% of the old growth in all of the state forests. So this is a premium area. I mean, this isn't just some patch in the woods somewhere. This is an area that's really special. And it was recognized, like I say, by not only Bob Orr, but also Doc Bowen, who reinforced that when he became governor later. The other thing is that the IFA has been involved in a four-year study called the Eco Blitz, in which scientists from all over the Midwest who are experts in their field have been doing a baseline study of an inventory of all living things in the forest. So to target one of our study areas, now, mind you now, we pull permits for each and every study, so the DNR is fully aware of all of this, but to target this area, and especially right in the heart of our study, it's vindictive. It's the DNR, it's Jack Seifert, the head of the Department of Forestry, flexing his muscles. So part of the emphasis is to make it known that this is just a very special area and that the DNR is doing this for reasons other than forest management.
And what were some of the results of that Eco Blitz study?
The identification of almost 4,000 plant and animal species, including several rare and endangered, like the pygmy shrew. It's one of the smallest mammals on the planet. It's about the size of a bumblebee. And it takes a mature, undisturbed forest to have an environment that it can survive in. And they found pygmy shrews, they found smoky shrews, they found cerulean warblers, Indiana bats, rattlesnakes. All these creatures are either on the federally endangered species list or they're on the protected list in Indiana. And all of these creatures either demand an undisturbed forest or highly benefit from being in an undisturbed forest. The other thing is, the way the DNR is logging now is it's highly mechanized. So they come in with these giant machines called cellar bunchers and giant skidding machines, and these things have enormous tires, and they churn up the forest floor, which totally degrades the plant life and the mycelium that exists in the forest floor. And doing so, these machines arrive covered in mud from the previous tract, and they are spreading invasive Japanese stilt grass. And once Japanese stilt grass makes its way into a forest area, it's almost impossible to control, and it completely dominates all the other plants, wiping out the native plant species.
You had mentioned that the Forest Alliance is encouraging people to call the governor's office. When does that need to be completed by? When are you expecting to hear anything from the governor's office?
Well, that's a good question. He was interviewed on Channel 6 News two nights before the timber sale last Thursday, and his statement at that time was that nothing has been decided. Now, even if the timber buyer ends up fulfilling his end of the contract, and he had 14 days from the day of the sale to pay his money, and theoretically at that point he could then begin the process of logging. But up until the moment that they begin logging, the governor can always reverse the process and return the money to this timber buyer. So we're urging people to continue to call until Governor Holcomb makes a decision on this. And then if the sale goes through, our mission is to continue to work for legislation to protect at least 10% of our state forests, which frankly is in the mandate of the Department of Natural Resources. And they have chosen not to follow it. And then just one little point about Hamilton Logging Company. This is a company that's pretty well known in Brown County because they've been involved in a couple of legal actions about 7 years ago. They were charged with felony theft and not following best management practices. That case was active for 2 years, and eventually the then prosecutor, Jim Oliver, then dropped the charges because he couldn't prove intent. But then a property owner hired Hamilton Logging to log her property, and they tore it up so egregiously that she won a $75,000 settlement in court. Because they did, their amount of remediation was reduced to $55,000. So the very people who have been charged with doing this logging in this most special area have a checkered past, and that's a matter of deep concern.
Dave Seastrom with the Indiana Forest Alliance as a volunteer, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
You're listening to the best of 2017 on WFHB. I'm your host and WFHB News Director, Wes Martin. Support for WFHB is provided by attorneys Eric Slotograph and Ben Neoff. Slotograph Neoff is located at 200 East 3rd Street in downtown Bloomington. Assisting families and small businesses in meeting the legal challenges of life, providing estate planning and wills, as well as family law services. More information is available at 812-332-6000 or at slotographlegal.com. Slotograph Neoff, law for business, community, and life. Support for the Daily Local News comes from MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com. In this next piece, I speak with IU professor Brian Powell. Powell headed a study about American attitudes to the denial of services to same-sex couples. The study originated over media attention and public reaction to the Masterpiece Cake Shop court case in Colorado, in which a gay couple were turned away after requesting a wedding cake. Powell says his study found that the legal justifications behind both sides of the Masterpiece Cake Shop case did not mirror public attitudes or rationales.
My collaborators, Landon Schnabel and Lauren Apgar, and I were really interested in understanding how does the public think about the denial of service to same-sex couples. we've heard so many different claims about what the denial of service means. We've heard the claim that denial of service is about protection of religious liberty. And we were really interested in finding out to what extent is that true. We also were interested in understanding whether or not people's views about denial of service is about individual businesses, or does it extend to corporations as well? Because the Supreme Court had a case involving Hobby Lobby that indicated that corporations, or what's known as closely held corporations, could have the same rights as individuals and deny things to different people. Finally, we were interested in whether or not people make a clear distinction between people's attitudes regarding denial of service to same-sex couples versus other groups. And we thought the obvious comparison would be interracial couples.
And why would that be an obvious comparison?
Just a couple of weeks ago, the Supreme Court was hearing a case about denial of service, in particular denial of service by a bakery to a same-sex couple. And in the discussion in the Supreme Court, people from both sides of the argument were bringing up the question of interracial couples. One side was saying interracial couples, if they shouldn't be denied service, well then same-sex couples should be treated exactly the same way. The other side said no, there are qualitative differences between the two groups. One reason people make this comparison is if we just go back 50 years ago, interracial couples were denied the same types of marital rights the same-sex couples were denied until just 2 years ago.
And can you talk about some of the findings of your study? We've talked briefly about what it is that your study was looking for. What did you end up discovering?
We first discovered that Americans do not distinguish between religious reasons and not religious reasons for denial of service. So when we gave a case in which someone denied service, a photographer denied service to a same-sex couple and said, I am doing this because I'm religious and I don't approve of same-sex marriage, people's responses to that question were no different than if the photographer said, I am not religious and I do not approve. Or in other words, despite the claims of many people that this is about religious, quote, freedom, people who believe you should deny service regardless of whether it's for religious reasons or not. This tells us that at least in the public's view, the debate about denial of service is not about religious liberty or religious freedom. A second finding is that people do distinguish between a self-employed photographer who says he's not going to give service versus a closely held corporation or a chain that says it's not going to deny service. In other words, even though the Supreme Court in certain cases have equated corporations or closely held corporations with persons, the American public does not. The third pattern, and we found this pattern to be really surprising, is that people's support for denial of service is greater for gay couples than for interracial couples. Now, that is not a surprising finding. But the surprising finding for us was across all the different types of scenarios we gave, 40% of Americans, that is close to two-fifths of Americans, said it is okay for a photographer to deny service to interracial couples, a protected class. What it does tell us is that the reasons that the public believes you should deny service has nothing to do with the legal claims that have been given regarding denial of service. Many people have made the argument that denial of service is about religious freedom. Our findings indicate that has nothing to do with the public view. Many people say that the denial of service by a photographer or a baker is about, you know, denial of freedom of expression or freedom of artistic expression or freedom of speech. The people in our sample almost never said anything like that. So one thing that our findings tell us is that how the public thinks about these issues use. It has nothing to do with the types of arguments that have been used legally to justify the denial of service. That's one key point that I think is very important. The other point is it is surprising that so many people do believe you can deny service. It's about evenly split regarding same-sex couples. 53% say you can, 47% say you cannot. I don't think it's necessarily a sign of prejudicial attitudes. In fact, the sample, which is of 2,000 of Americans, a sample representing all different spheres of American life, 60% of the sample was in favor of same-sex marriage. And I think that's really important. These were people who were not prejudiced in terms of their views about same-sex marriage, but they do believe that at least half of them believe that you can deny service. The reason why people often say you can deny service boils down to this general idea of libertarianism, that American businesses should be able to do what it wants. That in fact, the word that they kept on using, and this is a word that has kept on popping up, was the word anyone. You can deny service to anyone. In contrast, the people who say you can't deny service instead use the word everyone. To them, you need to treat everyone in the same fair manner. Another pattern that we found really surprising in terms of people's justifications is, and this was especially true among the people who said the person can deny service, but the respondent also believed was in favor of same-sex marriage. They often would say that what the photographer was doing was repugnant, and often people use different language that was much more colorful than that. But they said he has the right to deny service, but in turn, people have the right to boycott the photographer. They have a right to tell other people, do not go to the photographer. In other words, for many people, the idea was that that photographers and other businesses that do discriminatory practices ultimately are going to lose out. And it's this view that in a market economy, discriminatory practices are not profitable and people then will stop. Now, I think that's a very optimistic and naive view, and most research does not suggest that view is accurate, but it seems to be a key view of many Americans.
Dr. Powell, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the best of 2017 on WFHB. These and other news stories are available on our website, wfhb.org. Thank you for listening.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.